You know, but since Passover, we have still been reflecting a bit on just what Christ's sacrifice meant for all of us. And prior to Passover, we spent a lot of time, months, we heard messages, and we spent a lot of time doing what we are instructed to do every year, and that is to start looking inward and to start just seeing how much progress that we've made over the last year, since that last Passover, to dig deep and to see where we still need to, those things that we still need to work on. And I think if you're like me, you came up with a list, and in some cases you were happy that God had helped you improve in some areas. And as you dug deep, you were still maybe dismayed a bit that you still hadn't made as much progress as you wanted. But that's okay, as long as we are moving forward. And it's okay as long as we were able to identify those areas where we still have shortfalls. That's what it's about. Those areas that where we're not where we want to be yet. But it helps us refocus, brethren, when we do that, on those areas where we still need to overcome. My life and yours are busy, and sometimes busy and not with anything bad. It's just busy, just takes away the time that we have to study our Bibles, to pray, to meditate, to fast more than just on atonement. But what that does then, it does for me, as I see as I'm busy, I stay away from God's Word too much. And I don't focus enough then on those things that I personally need to work on. And so we've been working on that, hopefully, since Passover has gone by. But with all that's going on in the world and in our individual lives, again, it's so easy to get distracted and to focus our time on things that are not really truly important in the big picture. If we look at our calling, especially. You know, and tomorrow we're going to meet again to observe God's holy day plan and what it means for all mankind. And then it seems like once we get past Pentecost to me, even though it's still 4+ months away, man, the feast is here before you know it. And all those days start rolling in. But it is so exciting every year for me to start and to be in them and then just progress through God's holy days to once again be reminded of what His plan is for us. And I think it goes without saying that everyone here looks very forward to that day when we see the fulfillment of those days, that day when Christ returns and establishes His kingdom on earth. You know, that day that we'll rehearse later in the fall when He casts Satan and his demons into that bottomless pit, and so mankind won't have to deal with them for 1,000 years. And so, again, I think we're all ready, but I'm going to ask you again, are you ready for Christ to come back? Maybe we should put it a different way. I think all of us look forward to that day when Christ returns and establish His kingdom. I think all of us do. But again, are you ready for that? And I mean, are you spiritually ready? That's a hard question at times when we really study that again. Am I spiritually ready? Because we don't know when our day is up. I'd mentioned last week, just here a couple months ago, marked the 2-year anniversary of the untimely death of a very dear friend of mine. Sean Cordieu was his name. Sean was a pastor, United for a long time. He was the church reporter for the council. I knew Sean he died at age 50. I knew him for 42 years. He got home from a council meeting, did his thing with his family and his wife. His kids are mostly grown and out, but he was a night owl. And so it came time for his wife to go to bed. He kissed her goodnight, and they laid and talked for a while, and he got up, went downstairs, and went to work, but he just stayed up late. She got up in the morning, I don't think, like, Sean came to bed, and she went down, and he was at his desk. He passed away. Just untimely. His time, rather to be spiritually ready, was February 16th, 2022. So I ask each of you again, how much time do you have to get your own spiritual house in order? Because we understand, we really know in our hearts that the time is now. Right? We know that. Have any of you, besides the people from Richmond who I talked about this last week, have any of you heard of the Biographical Bible? It's called a Biographical Bible, but it's really not a Bible. But in this Biographical Bible, it mentions 3,237 different people. Now, I think what's sometimes confusing, though, is if you read on in that Bible, that is only just a little over half, 1,794 of those people have a unique name. So what that means is that, obviously, almost half of the people mentioned in the Bible share the same name with at least one other individual. A few examples. The Bible has five different Johns. There are 13 different Josephs. There are 31 Zechariahs. But the most interesting, and I could go on, but the most interesting point about this to me is that the characters that we read about in our Bible, whether it's one of these five Johns, one of these 13 Josephs, one of these 31 Zechariahs, had no idea that their story, that the story of their lives, or at least part of their lives, or at the very least their names, would be preserved for future generations to read about. And I have to ask myself, would they have conducted themselves differently if they knew they were going to be studied 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years later, 6,000 years later? Would they be proud of what's written about them? Would they be proud of their accomplishments, or would they be embarrassed? Would they hang their head in shame? You know, some of the people in our Bible we know have several chapters written about them. Others simply their name listed. Will their reference be one that we have looked to as an example of righteous conduct, or will it be one that we've referred to as a really bad example, or worse, evil? Turn over to 2 Timothy, if you will. One of the worst examples of this that I could think of is in 2 Timothy 2, verses 17 and 18. Again, one of the worst examples here, I think. 2 Timothy 2, verse 17 and 18. It says, "And their message will spread like cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort, who have strayed concerning the truth, saying that the resurrection is already past, and they overthrow the faith of some." Think about that, brethren. Paul had to specifically name two church members publicly. Right? Their names recorded for all time as examples of men who strayed from the truth because they couldn't, basically, if we read the whole story, couldn't stay away from arguing about words. Couldn't avoid giving in to intellectual vanity. And the horrible result of that is their name being forever linked to false doctrine. And to me, more importantly, the shame of overthrowing the faith of other church members. I will speak for all of us, I think, and say none of us would ever want to be guilty of that. Right? But on the other hand, we find quite the compliment over in Matthew 11. Kind of a just the opposite side of the coin, Matthew 11. We're going to see, again, just quite the compliment referring to John the Baptist. Matthew 11, verse 11. It says, "Assuredly, I say to you, among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist." After reading or reminiscing about my friend's passing, I went back and reread a touching, very touching tribute that was written about him by Mr. Ed Dowd. And it described the man that I knew, the man that his family knew, and he was a very godly man. But it talked about just all of these wonderful things that he had accomplished, the things that he was known for, how he loved the people, how he served them. And I asked myself, and I ask you this, what will they say about you? That is my title. What will they say? Put another way, what would a tribute written about you say? I guess one other way we could phrase it is, what if God decides to have recorded your life now for those who will be alive in the millennium to read? Think about that. The men and women that we read about in our Bibles had no idea that we would be talking about them today, and that we would be marveling at the incredible failure of Hymenaeus and Philetus, and the incredible success of John the Baptist. So I ask everyone here today, how do you know whether that might happen to you? What if the story of your life is written down for future generations to read? There have been questions over the years that said, is the book of Acts, is it complete? There have been those that have speculated that it might not be, because there's no amen at the conclusion of the book of Acts. We don't know that. If it ever will be, it's up to God. But if so, would your story be recorded there? And if it was, would a future reader of an updated Bible find inspiration of your life story? Or would your story be held up as an example of what not to do? Think about that, brethren. What commentary might God have inspired some future author to add that has you included? Well, the good news is we all have time to finish writing that story. This time's not up yet. Our day isn't here. We still have time to write those remaining verses about our life. You see, it's not complete. But for today, let's assume that people living in the millennium will want to know about what it was like right before Christ returned. What it was like, how did you endure those things when they read about 9/11? And they go, you were alive then. What was it like? Or when we read about it, hear about all the terrible murders, the atrocities going on in the world and in our communities at times. People living and born in the millennium will have no idea. They'll want to know what it was like. Think about that. But before we assume that it's possible that God might inspire further additional chapters of the book of Acts, let's clarify something and be very clear about this over in Revelation chapter 22. Revelation 22, let's read verses 18 and 19. You see, if future chapters are written, it will be added by God. It is God's at God's direction and God's decision. It tells us very clearly here in Revelation 22, verse 18 and 19. It says, "For I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book, if anyone adds to these things," right? If any person adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues that are written in this book. If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part from the book of life, from the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book. I am not suggesting any man would ever write a story about us and try to include it in this book. This is, if it happens, it would be God-inspired. So again, we get the point. Humans, as human beings, we cannot add or subtract from the inspired words of our Bible. However, God can, and He might, He perhaps will add to the pages of the Bible for, again, for future human beings who live during the world tomorrow to read about. And maybe there'll be inspired messages that they might want to hear about those who live in this time. But for today, we're going to just ask a hypothetical question about whether or not future stories will be written, and whether or not, if they were, and your name and your life story was included, what would it say? What would it say? What are some possible scenarios just from this congregation that might be written about? You know, what about the events that we're living through today in regards to world conditions? How are we, living now in the 21st century, how are we part of the church history for the 20th and the 21st century? You see, if we are the last generation living on earth, they've been saying that for thousands of years, right? But if we are indeed the last generation on earth before Christ's second coming, don't you suppose that the people of the future, again, would like to know what life was like for us in those last days? Wouldn't they be interested to know what it was like to live in a time when men did whatever they wanted, when they walked into places and shot people, when the killings, the serial killings we hear about, that we lived through that, and that we just fought through that every day, wouldn't they want to know that? Wouldn't they like to know, turn over to 2 Timothy, wouldn't they like to know, again, people living in the millennium, born during the millennium, or even those resurrected after the millennium, wouldn't they like to know what it was like to live in a time where, in 2 Timothy 3, verse 2, when this is what it was like, when this describes the people. 2 Timothy 2, starting chapter 2 Timothy 3, starting in verse 2. Wouldn't they like to know what it was like when it says, when men were lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, when they were proud, when they were blasphemers, when they were disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, when men were unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without control, self-control, I'm sorry, when they were brutal, when they were despisers of good, when they were traitors, when they were headstrong, when they were haughty, when they were lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. You see, brethren, I believe that Christ's return is, I'm going to say imminent, but it's getting closer every day. I can't imagine, as many generations haven't, that it can be much longer. But just imagine, don't you think people living, let's say, 500 years from now, that these descriptive words that we've read in 2 Timothy 3 might be hard to understand? You know, just think of the last 10 years, just the things that we've seen, and it's going to get worse. You know, a story that comes back to mind, and I just can't get out of my head. Remember the man working for a taxi company who was killing random people, and then he'd go on and pick up others and take them to where they're going, you know, between shootings? Things like that will be unheard of from them. How can they understand, again, the evil of flying an aircraft into buildings, killing thousands? Or what we see on the news every day, the repeated acts of people walking into safe areas. the schools, whatever, stores, churches, and killing innocent people. People living in the millennium are going to have a hard time to get that concept. They're going to say, well, that's awful. You lived through that? How terrible. How did you do that? The people of the world tomorrow will read about the Holocaust. And they'll just, as hard as it is for us to believe, they'll have such a hard time digesting that. You know, they're going to ask things like, what could it have possibly been like to live in such an evil world? And at some point then they're going to click and say, now I understand why Satan and his demons were put away. Why they were imprisoned. They're going to say things like, I'm so thankful that we didn't have to endure his evil influences. And I'm sure that as we teach them and as they ask questions or maybe read about us, they're going to find our stories sometimes hard to believe. And again, perhaps our stories will be recorded. You know, there's just so many questions. I mentioned this last week. I'll mention it again. You know, just when you meet Noah and his family in the world tomorrow, you know, what's something you might like to ask them? You know, God destroyed the world. He said evil was everywhere. I mean, well, okay. How does it compare to what we have now? Is it worse? Was it not as bad? I want to know what all those people said to him for 120 years as they walked by, besides, hey, crazy old man, you're building a boat in the desert. You know, what did he have to endure? But wouldn't we want to know what the world was like prior to the flood? Turn over to Genesis 6, because God didn't record a lot of that for us, but we can read a couple things in Genesis. Genesis 6 is where we'll go. Genesis 6. Start in verse 5 and 6. Genesis 6. Now verse 5. It said, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And verse 6, and the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. How bad was it? How bad was it? Drop down to verse 11. It says, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked on the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Again, how bad was it? There's really nothing said about what life was like for Noah and his sons. There's really no message of his warning message to the people to repent. You know, if we read further here, we see that there's no mention, anything of that, but all we're told is that it says here the people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage and weren't aware of what was about to happen until the flood came. And then it was obviously too late. They were destroyed. My point is there's so much information left out. And God had his very own very specific reasons for only telling us what we needed to know. Right? But will more be written about of this story about life prior to the flood? Will it ever be written down additional information for the benefit of the people who live before the flood, 100 years or whatever before the flood? You know, how will God teach those people when they have their chance, when they are resurrected? Will there be similarities in life about what was life like in the last days before the flood and the last days before the tribulation? I'm thinking there will be. We don't know. But will these stories, brethren, be used to help teach the people of the world tomorrow in the great white throne judgment? We don't know. Time will tell. But let's come back to our world today. What are some of the various issues that we face today as members of the Church of God? You know, we like to get the context of what life was like in biblical times, but what if, brethren, what if our lifetime, this time that we live in before the tribulation, what if it becomes biblical times as well? What are some of the issues that affect each of us individually as members of God's church living in 2024? There are doctrinal issues in the church. There always are. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. You know, we've had a long history of needing to prove doctrines that we were taught and that we studied and that we proved to be right, and things that we hold dear and hold fast. But every time, every so often, they come back around, you know, new moons, the name of God, different things, and they cycle through. But it's not new. Turn back to Acts 23. You know, doctrinal issues are a major part of the discussion of the New Testament church members. And as we turn to Acts 23 here, we're going to kind of jump into the section where Paul is on trial. And do you remember what the great controversy was at this time?
Circumcision?
Yep. So let's look at that. Acts 23, we'll read verses 6 through 10. Again, so Paul's on trial. Says, but when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead. I am being judged." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Verse 8, for the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party rose and protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." Finally, verse 10, now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. We could say they were upset. That'd be an understatement, right? They're so divided about whether or not there was a resurrection that they were about to riot. And it says they were about to literally pull Paul apart, fighting over it. Dissension amongst the church, you know, about different doctrines is not new. Acts 15 is where we will find about the dissension, the doctrinal question, if you will, regarding circumcision. Acts 15, starting in verse 1. Acts 15, verse 1, and it says, and certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, quote, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Therefore, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them should go to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders about this question. So, understand, this is a major doctrinal question in the church at this time. You know, so much so that they said, you guys need to go talk about this. Let's go to Jerusalem. So they had basically what we would call a ministerial conference on the matter. We'll come back to that in a minute. But there were other disagreements too. Over in 1 Corinthians 8, you don't have to turn to, but there was a discussion and disagreement on whether or not it was okay to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. As we go on through the New Testament, we'll see then, again, controversy after controversy over the years, and division to other issues such as the Sabbath day, as the holy days, the Trinity. Again, though, my point is that a record of church doctrinal issues from the early church is recorded for us here in the Bible. What about the issues of today? Again, what will people read in the future about us in regards to what doctrinal issues we had as a church and how we resolved them? In many, many cases, they're going to look and say, well, they resolved them by starting their own church. We can look back. We were part of that. In one sense, you know, we had a major doctrinal problem with what the worldwide church did in the mid-90s. And we just couldn't tolerate that. Right? We understand that they rejected almost every fundamental belief that we cherished. And that's part of church history. Will that story be shared with future millennial generations? Will your name be recorded in that account? And how you dealt with it? And what you struggled with and how you finally came to where you are? What about other ongoing doctrinal points? Are there thorny issues for you in any of them? Are you in agreement with the church's fundamental doctrines? Think about this, you know, there are, throughout the greater churches of God, there are so many different beliefs and controversies right now. Things like sacred names, I mentioned that, new moons, how to count Pentecost. There are discussions and different beliefs on tithing. There are discussions and dissension amongst some groups about whether a person should eat out on the Sabbath. There are some people who believe Christ must return on Pentecost, or there's others who believe that he must return on trumpets. There's some people who say the only way to run a church is a one man in charge. And there's others that say that's not the way to do it, that we should do it by a council like United does. There's dissension, there's discussion on all of these things. There are doctrinal issues about how the work is done, how it should be done. Some people say, just prepare the bride. Don't be preaching the gospel to anyone else. There's a lot of controversy, there's a lot of dissension, there's a lot of doctrinal issues in the greater churches of God. My point again, though, will future generations reading about the church in 2024 read that there were disputes and contentions about such issues? Maybe. What would we want them to say about us in regards to them? You know, 1 Corinthians 11, you could turn over there. There were issues again, we'll talk about just briefly, back in Paul's time. 1 Corinthians 11 talks about the issue of women having their head covered. You know, it also talks about the conduct of members as they come to the Passover services. And as we'll see, in verse 16, there were apparently, you know, different views on this. And Paul wrote that that's not okay. Notice in verse 16, it says, but if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom. He's saying, that's not what we do. Nor do the churches of God. Right? We have some other places in our Bible, some very, very clear scriptures of that disputing about, specifically, about non-salvational issues is simply that were not to do. You can write some of these down. We won't turn to all of them, but write down Philippians 2, verse 14. It tells us there, do all things without complaining and disputing. You can write down 1 Timothy 1, verse 4. It says, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies which cause dispute rather than godly edification which is in the faith. Again, these are non-salvational issues we're talking about here. 1 Timothy 6, 4. He is proud, knowing nothing, but is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, from which come envy, strife, reviling, and evil suspicions. You can also write down 2 Timothy 2, verse 23. Very clear. It says, but avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. There are a number of other verses we can turn to, but clearly, I think we understand here that we have clear instruction that such issues are to be resolved and they're not to be argued about. We are, as we're told, we are to be of one mind. We are to be in agreement. We are to be in harmony. God wants His people to be at peace. And He expects us to be speaking the same thing. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Paul is quite emphatic here. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, let's read verses 10 through 13. He says, now I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing. Right? And that there are no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. For it has been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are contentions among you. Verse 12, now I say this, that each of you says, I am of Paul, or I am of Apollos, or I am of Cephas, or I am of Christ. Verse 13, is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you, or were you baptized in the name of Paul? You know, Paul's fired up here. He's emphatic about the behavior of the members of the congregation. And he's basically saying, it's enough. He's saying, I'm not going to tolerate this bickering, these divisions, this arguments amongst you. But I appreciate his words here. He was very clear. He was very certain. And he called it as it was. Turn back a couple chapters, 1 Corinthians 3, verses 2 and 3. He goes on, he says, I fed you with milk and not with solid food, for until now you were not able to receive it. Saying you were spiritually immature and you still are. He says, and even now you're still not able, for you're still carnal. For where there are envy and strife and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? Do you think, brethren, at times that maybe we make too much of the fact that there are certain doctrinal, you know, divisions and administrative differences in the church? Is it okay to get along as, okay to have disagreements, I say, as long as we all get along okay? Turn back to Romans 16. If we think that it is, we need to see what it says here in Romans 16, verses 17 and 18. Because we all know the answer, right? It's not okay. Paul, again, writes about here, he tells us, Romans 16, starting in verse 17, he says, now I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. For those who are such do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by smooth words and flattering speech deceive the hearts of the simple. What this tells me is that I have a responsibility to note those people, right? To note anyone among us who would cause division or offense to others by speaking things that, as it says here, are contrary. Where is it? Contrary to the doctrine which you have learned. We need to avoid those people. Right? Do you think God's serious about this? We read about two of them earlier, right? Hymenaeus and Philetus. God has recorded these people in the Bible who failed to do these things. We could never, ever want our name recorded in a similar way. Let's look at 3 John, chapter 1. 3 John, verse 9. Now we read about Hymenaeus and Philetus. What about over in 3 John chapter 9? What it tells us here, verses 9 and 10. So John here says, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, that's not a very flattering thing, does not receive us. And therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, right? But that's simply not the way we have to conduct ourselves in the church of God. If there are divisions, is there any strife, we have to, brethren, we have to get past these things. We have to resolve them. And we have to conduct ourselves as the spiritually mature and converted people that we say we are, and that I know we are. Ephesians 4. Ephesians chapter 4. If our stories are ever recorded, wouldn't it be wonderful to see the Roanoke or the Richmond congregation described the way that they are here in Ephesians 4, verses 2 through 4. Verse 2, again, let's say this is describing our Roanoke church as people look back on it. Jumping in the story here, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called, and one hope of your calling. Wouldn't it be wonderful if future references are made, maybe even in Acts in the future, that if the Roanoke Church was written about, that is specifically mentioned how much unity and peace there was? What about relationship issues, brethren? Turn back to Philippians 4. The New Testament, we understand that, the New Testament church specifically, had certain problems with relationship issues, and we see the names of people again involved recorded for all of us to see. Philippians 4, let's read verses 2 and 3. Philippians 4, verse 2. I implore you, Odia, and I implore Syntyche, to be of the same mind in the Lord. He's saying, come on, you guys. And I urge you also, true companion, help these women who labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. So apparently, they weren't of the same mind about something. You know, he, who knows, he may have been asking Timothy to help resolve the issues that were going on between them. But notice what Paul said. He said, Paul said, whatever the problem is, whatever that problem is, fix it. He says, settle it and be of the same mind. Brother Ned, it was vitally important then and still today. Now, he talked over and over again about the need for brotherly love amongst the brethren. Note especially here, let's turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Again, he mentioned this so often, but here in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 9 and 10, is one example here that should strike us all. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 9, it says, but concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. Basically saying, I shouldn't even have to be talking about this. Right? Why am I having to talk about this? You yourselves are taught by God to love one another, and indeed you do towards all the brethren who are in Macedonia. Maybe it says all the brethren in Roanoke or all the brethren in Richmond. He says, but we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more. I think that's beautiful. Again, if we substituted the name of our own congregation, doesn't it sound even better? We all understand that one of the toughest things in life can be relationship issues. They're so hard to deal with, so hard to overcome. You know, some of them go on and on for years. Some of them never get resolved. But they have to be. None of us are exempt from having them. We understand that. Also, we have to understand none of us is exempt from maybe having it written down for someone else to read about in the future. Now, we read earlier about the dispute between Paul and Barnabas over the circumcision question. Look what happened over here. Let's go back to Acts. Let's jump back to when we talked about how they were sent to Jerusalem to the ministerial conference. Right, look what happened here back in Acts 15. Immediately, okay, timeline, this is immediately after that conference was over in Jerusalem. Acts 15, we'll pick up the story in verse 36 and read through verse 40. It says, then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they're doing. And now Barnabas was determined to take with them John, called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. The contention, this is immediately after all this conference, the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another, and so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed. Now again, I think about when Barnabas and Paul are resurrected and they're reading the story, don't you think they're going to be a little bit embarrassed? Weren't they supposed to be setting the example for all of us? If we look at the other side of that, brethren, aren't you and I supposed to be setting an example of godly conduct as well? You know, we've read stories here. There are so many more. Shame on us, brethren, if we have sharp contentions amongst ourselves too. Again, I don't want to have my name written in future chapters. I know you do not either. That of conduct like that. Instead, what we want is something like what Paul wrote to the Philippians back in Philippians chapter 1. This is things like I want to be written about if that happens, and you do as well, I know. If future generations have something recorded from our life, it would be wonderful if they wrote about us what it says in Philippians 1 verse 27. It says, only let your conduct, only let what you do every day, how you live your life, what you do when you're not at church, only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, that I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. We go on to chapter 2. Pick up in verse 2. It says, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Verse 3, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. And let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interests of others. Does that describe, I'm new here, been here not long, but does that describe Roanoke? Probably. I don't know. We want it to, right? Just consider, wouldn't it be great if every congregation of the church could be described that way? You know, we've read that scripture so many times over the years, and I think we all agree that that is the standard. That is how we have to conduct ourselves. Right? It's the expectation. We know that. But are we there yet? And would a future chapter written about our congregation say, you know, That Roanoke or that Richmond congregation, you know, for the most part, they were like-minded and one of accord. But there was that member A and member B that they just seemed to continually agitate the congregation by their attitude, you know. They were arrogant, or they're talking about things that acting like they know more than everyone else, you know, presenting themselves as the authority on all subjects. Don't forget member C. Remember how sharp his tongue was? If you didn't watch yourself, they would really chew you up and spit you out. I remember they alienated people. What would they say about our congregation? What we want them to say, and again, the story's not done yet. What we want them to say is, oh, I remember that Roanoke, that Richmond congregation. I remember them being like-minded. And I remember you walk in there, people were so friendly. And they came up and greeted you. And you just saw humility amongst the group. And it seemed that they were continually watching out for the needs of everyone else in the congregation. That's what we want them to say. And that if that story was written today, that might be it. Again, I'm the new guy. But I've been around church for a long time. I've been in so many wonderful congregations. Wonderful, wonderful. And as wonderful as we were, that couldn't have been written about us. Because we weren't quite where yet we needed to be. Because we are still men. We are still human. You see, brethren, we still have time to write that chapter and that description about how people will describe us and our congregation. What other things do you suppose might be written about our congregation if future chapters are written in the book of Acts? What do you think? Well, I think that we've all heard stories about God's people around the world who I remember a lot of when they were the feast videos, where people they'd show these videos of people in Africa or in Asia somewhere or somewhere, and the incredible efforts that they took to just get to church. I told the story last week in Richmond. I had a beloved friend, Louis was his name. Louis was one of the first people I met when I came to church in the early 80s. And he, at that time, he was probably in his 70s. But as a child, he had gotten encephalitis. And he was 12 years old, and it really affected his, he was, that didn't affect his mind, but his body affected. He was on crutches, he had no balance, very little control of his arms. When we go out to eat on Sabbath sometimes, and when he ordered ribs, I'm like, oh boy. You know, and he'd always laugh about it because he'd try, they had rib juice everywhere, but we had fun. But Louis was one of the best examples of perseverance with all of his physical issues and all of the harassment that he'd get from the people in town and the young kids when he'd go out. When he first started attending church, one of the first churches in Illinois, it was, he couldn't drive. And so he had to take a bus. But the bus only went on Friday afternoon. And so, and he had to take three different connections to get there. So we had to leave Thursday to catch the Friday bus. And then it took him 2 days to get home, just to go to Sabbath services. His first Sabbath service, he made it all the way over there. Didn't have a place to stay Friday night, so he stayed at the train place. Went there Sabbath the next day. Nobody was there. It was the Feast of Tabernacles, and he didn't know. But Louis was an incredible, incredible example who went to enormous efforts to attend services. I would pick him up when we had 10 o'clock services. I would pick him up about 9 o'clock. But to get ready and to take a shower, he started at 3 a.m. every day because it took him that long because his body wouldn't work. It took him 6 hours just to get ready for church. And he never missed. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. And I know that in the future, he's going to be an example for many others when they read about him or when they understand his story. But in the future, when you want to be inspired and motivated sometimes to press on, wouldn't it be helpful to read a chapter in the Bible about someone that you've known that was able to overcome huge challenges in their life? Huge obstacles that never, ever gave up. You probably know some people that you've gone to church with over the years. There are other stories that we'll read about, people we don't know, but God does. But even in this Richmond or Roanoke congregation and in the Richmond congregation, we have people who face severe trials every day. We have people going through severe illnesses. We have people just dealing with issues, relationship issues, marriage issues, financial issues, all kinds of things. God understands what's going on. He knows. But there are so many people, brethren, I hope we can see today that are incredible examples of patience. You know, of trust in God, you know, of mercy, of love, of dependence on God. They're great examples. And again, it's not out of considering that God might choose to record some of those stories for future generations. What example, though, do we look at when we think of people who don't have the willpower, and just wanted to give up all the time? We knew people like that. We knew people that finally just said, I'm tired. I can't do this anymore. Or people who just didn't exercise God's Holy Spirit. You know, think about the Israelites when they left Egypt. Remember their story? You know, why did you bring us out here to die in this wilderness? Things were going great. We got him out of Egypt then. Everything's going fine. Now I'm thirsty. Why did you bring us out here to die? Wouldn't we have been better off to be in Egypt? You know, just think about the Israelite story. Isn't there some point where they're going to be embarrassed when they read it? You know, we sounded like a bunch of whiners. What about the other hand? Joshua and Caleb are great examples. We read about their examples of faith and how they completely trusted to fight God to fight their battles for them. Or we read about, when we talk about the Israelites, the men who were examples of failure, like the unnamed man who didn't believe what God said and went out and gathered sticks on the Sabbath. Remember that? Or the rebellion of Korah. All of these stories written for us. Their lives, they had no idea their story was going to be written for us. Let's look at 1 Timothy. We have a couple of New Testament names here that, I will use the word, live in disgrace, at least their names. 1 Timothy 1, verse 20, we're going to read about a gentleman named Alexander. 1 Timothy 1, verse 20, he mentioned, we've seen Hymenaeus' name before, but now he throws in, "Who of whom are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I delivered to Satan that they may learn not to blaspheme." I wouldn't want my name written there. You drop on down to 2 Timothy. It talks about Alexander again. 2 Timothy 4, verse 14. We don't have a lot of information about Alexander. But again, it says 2 Timothy 4, verse 14. It says, "Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his works." I told the story in Richmond. An elderly lady I was helping one time do something, she goes, "Joe, I hope God gives you everything you have coming." And I'm going, "I don't want that." That's not what she meant, but, right? We don't have, again, much more information than this, but wouldn't it be awful to have something like that written about you in a future edition, if happened, in the Bible? Now think about it. I doubt if Alexander understood or knew that he was, as it describes here, that knew that he was blaspheming. And what we can pick up is that he apparently had been a church leader. Right? He apparently had spent some time with Paul, anyway, maybe a lot of time. But how did he harm Paul? I don't know. It doesn't say, but knowing how we think as humans, I'm sure that Alexander thought that he was right, whatever was going on, and that Paul was wrong. Or here's 2 Timothy 4, verse 10, what about Demas? He says, "For Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed for Thessalonica." Why would Demas do that? Why hadn't he captured the vision of God's kingdom and throw that all away again for the glamour, it says, of Thessalonica? What will they say about you if your story is written, brethren? Oh, that member A, I remember them. They were such a pillar in the church. Remember how much how solid he was, and you remember then all of a sudden he's gone. He left. He got caught up in the things of the world. See, again, that chapter, that verse never has to be written, brethren, does it? Never has to be written. And we do know that things can be hard. They can be difficult for us. We know that, right? We have hard times. There are times we are times of loneliness. There are times when we are frustrated. There are times when we are confused, and there are times in our lives, brethren, that sometimes we are disillusioned. But does that give us a reason to ever give up? See, are we any different from the New Testament Christians? 2 Corinthians chapter 4. See, they had times similar to us. They had hard times. They had long times of loneliness, and times of frustration, times of confusion, times of disillusionment. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 8, though, says, "We are hard-pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We are persecuted, but we're not forsaken. And we are struck down, but we're not destroyed." What did Paul say then later, as after he talked about these hard times? Read on down here to verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, we'll pick it up in verse 16. After he'd written about all these hard times, what does he say? He says, "Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. And while we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal." See, brethren, that's the vision that we have at all times. No matter what's going on in our lives, no matter what the struggle is, the confusion, the loneliness, the strife, the disillusion, the severe trials, that's the vision we have to have. See, that's the vision and the confidence and the faith that will see us through anything, no matter what. And I mentioned earlier that the book of Acts is only one of a couple books in the Bible that appears to just end abruptly. And again, some have speculated that maybe God intends to add more chapters to the book at some point. You know, maybe chronicling the lives of people in the end times. We don't know that. We don't know what God will do. But if that happened, there will be many stories written showing courage. There'll be many stories written, additional stories written showing faith. There will be stories written about people enduring incredible hardship, yet never ever giving up. There will be stories from the end time, brethren, about people laying down their lives for the sake of their calling, to do what is right. You know, I mentioned it earlier, but I won't be surprised if books are written. I'm pretty sure I'll see Louis' name in there. And he will be a great, leave a great impression for people when they read their stories. But again, I ask you this, will your story, brethren, ever be included if there are future chapters written? Because if you've been around long, most of us know at least a person or two along the way that has given up. They've given up what they understood and what they believed, we think. They've given up the fight, right? Abandoned the faith. They've gone back to the ways of the world. Some of us know people like Demas. And then, thankfully, we probably also know many more people who are sterling examples of their courage, of what they had to go through, of their faith. People are great examples of their spiritual integrity. And I would guess that some of you are sitting here in this room today. Some of them, though, brethren, like my friend Louis, and like my friend Sean, have already had the chapters of their lives completed and are now asleep. They are waiting for the resurrection and for their crown of glory. Take a moment, brethren, and think what might be written in future chapters of the book of Acts about some of these men and women that I've known and you have. Think about, will their story, or will my story or yours, inspire someone to tears 500 years from now? Could their story, your story, my story, could it possibly, though, motivate someone to overcome, to press on, to not give up, and face any adversity 700 years from now? We know, brethren, there's still going to be tests and trials to overcome, even in the world tomorrow. Good news, Satan, the devil, won't be there. But human nature still will be, and it's still going to have to be overcome. And character is still going to have to be built. And we understand that the people just won't be robots and get everything. So as I conclude, brethren, think about what might be written about you. There are trials left in your life to face that you haven't handled yet. Right? There are opportunities for service that are going to come your way that you haven't encountered yet. There are tests of your faith that haven't become known to you yet. Perhaps they will today, maybe tomorrow. But how will a future book, brethren, of Acts record your life in 2024? Last scriptures we'll look at are going to be over in Hebrews 11. I think all of us understand that if our names are ever recorded, this would be a great place to have them recorded. Hebrews 11, we understand, is the faith chapter. Hebrews 11 is picking it up in verse 13. It says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth." My friend Sean and my friend Louis, that describes them. Verse 14, "For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now," verse 16, "but now they desire a better," that is, a heavenly country. "And therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." Drop on down to verse 39 of Hebrews 11. It says, "And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us." Again, if I'm ever written about in the future, I would love for it to be included in the faith chapter. And if I'm ever written about, I hope that my story would be the version of me that strove every day to be more Christ-like. That story about me, I hope that it would include that he spent his time focusing on the truly important things in life. I would hope that my story could be written someday, describing me as the person that people could count on, and that would always express godly love in all situations. And I would really love to be described someday as like David was, as a person who was a man after God's own heart. I still have a lot of work to do to be that person that I want to be described as. But I pray, brethren, that God grant you and I and these to join these courageous men and women of the faith chapter and have our names perhaps written about later for others as examples for others. Again, I still have much work to do to be that person that I described. What about you? When you are gone, what will they say?